So, the title for today is Royalty and the Transformation of Frogs, also known as Christmas. So, as that makes perfect sense, I'll just leave it right there and continue. And we'll get back to that strange title. Christmas. It's kind of easy to get to the place of, you know, thinking about Christmas and its beautiful Christmas trees and its presents, and you gather around and, you know, we kind of meditate about the fact that God's so good. He gave us all sorts of beautiful things. And that's just kind of where we end with this. But one thing that's kind of a little bit background story, I'm also an engineer. And something that kind of took me down that road was this passion, this kind of desire and drive of believing that there's always more, that there's always possibility for progress. There's always possibility to say that we've done something like this, but what if? Like, what if we dream a little bit bigger? And that same kind of why question that's driven me into engineering has also sort of shaped my spiritual life a little bit. And having children now, I kind of get to rediscover life. You know, you get so used to a lot of things. And then when you have children, it's like this mind-blowing experience again of like discovering just, I don't know, rain and snow and all these things we take for granted. So I kind of want to start it off with the reason for today is I want us to kind of zoom out again and just rethink Christmas and kind of let our minds just be fascinated all over again by this thing that so easily becomes commercialized or so easily just becomes a fairy tale for us. And so I want to leave us, I kind of want to set the tone for this. If nothing else, put your minds in gear of saying, I'm going to rethink what I believe about Christmas. I'm going to just rethink what I believe about God. One of the amazing things about Jesus is that he brought revelation, but he brought a revelation in a way that leads to transformation. So sometimes when I do stuff, David, my son, would just look at me and be like, do it again, Daddy, do it again. And that's not why Jesus came. He didn't come to do these amazing things so that we can kind of like clap and be like, wow, Jesus, that was really cool. Do it again. You know, he didn't just come to give us a good magic show. He came to let transformation happen in our lives. And some spiritual guy from the past with the name Callistos Ware said, Christianity is not merely a philosophical theory or moral code, but involves a direct sharing in divine life and glory, a transforming union with God that's face to face. And so there's one kind of concept we have to rediscover when we think about Christmas, and that's the idea of royalty. Now, for us, royalty and kingdom are really strange words. We don't really get it. We live in democracies, right? We have votes. We have rights. We vote people into power, and we have to sense that, you know, this is our nation and our whatever, whether it's a company or a nation. But when it comes to this idea that there's a king and a kingdom, to be really honest, it's really weird to us. We read it in stories. We watch movies about it. But in terms of our own internal thinking in our minds, none of us ever think about kingdom living. In fact, it's kind of strange when you go to different countries. You know, Europe is a little bit more socialistic than the United States, for instance. And that's a different shift in how people think. And sometimes that scares people in America, that they think, oh, we're going to become communists if we keep on sharing our stuff too much. The point is, we all are very entrenched in our cultures. We're familiar with that. But when it comes to this idea of king and kingdom, it's strange to us. I want to show you a photo. A couple of years ago, I went to the UK for a work project, and I decided to visit Windsor Castle. Have any of you guys ever been there? This place is absolutely mind-blowing. So it was built in the 11th or 10th century, and during its lifetime, it ended up being the most expensive building project in the Middle Ages, in England at least. I mean, you walk into this place, and it's just gold and extravagance like you just absolutely cannot imagine. I'm pretty sure that if you take like one square meter in this place, it'll be more worth than all of my belongings and all of my family's belongings and everybody else we know. It's just, I mean, it's surreal. And to think that this is not a movie. People lived there for hundreds of years, almost 1,000 years. Can you imagine being in that fortress? You're a soldier or something, and there's like an invading army, and you're one of the guys stationed on the wall, and your task is to defend this kingdom. Or even more, that you're a subject living in this kingdom. You don't have rights, really. It's not like you start your business. But Jesus spoke quite a lot about kingdom. So one of the famous statements that he said all over was, seek first the kingdom, and everything else will be given to you. So it's kind of Jesus saying, I want to tell you a secret. Like, if you want to find a place to start with the kingdom. And over and over and over, Jesus went about and he shared the good news about what? The kingdom of God, right? Does that really sound like good news to anybody? If somebody would walk up to you and be like, I have such good news about the kingdom, you kind of like have a question mark on your face, right? Like, what's the point of that? I don't get it. So we kind of have to start with the beginning a little bit, because this has got incredibly profound implications for us, for our identity. And the story really begins, surprise, surprise, in Genesis 1. So Genesis 1, verse 26 to 28, it says the following. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals and all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Now the problem again is that kind of stuff can become very fairy tale-ish to us really quickly. Because I don't know about you, but I don't wake up in the morning thinking, oh my goodness, my dream is so to rule over the fish. I just want to be like the fish prince or something, right? That doesn't happen. But obviously there's wording and there's narrative around that God connected with the people in a certain point. And the point was, I created you to have a dominion over this world. Do you understand that you were created royal? I mean, it's breathtaking. Like, I mean, sometimes people are like dog people or like cat people, and you know, they have like an animal and it's like their baby. No, it's not your baby. It's maybe your animal, but it's not your baby. Right? We could kind of feel like that way with God sometimes. Like when God says, where is children? We kind of think he's just being nice. Like, where is little pet or something? That's not the case. Do you realize that God is your father? I mean, think about that. It's like not... Imagine the crown prince is your father. How would that shape your identity? Like, I know some people who are wealthy. And it's interesting to see the way that their children have sort of absorbed that identity compared to people maybe who grow up in poverty. They have a different mentality. These two children, the same age, they did nothing, right? All they've done so far is been born, and they grew up in a house a little bit. But this one child carry a completely different mentality. The way they think about life or success or business, all of that stuff, it just seems different. Now, the reality is, your dad is the living God himself. I mean, look at that. Look at that river. Your dad made that. I mean, if it was night, we could look up into the skies and we can see the oceans and we can see supernovas, and you can look at your hand and realize this incredible genetic wonder that's our body. That person who made that is your dad. Now, the problem is, all of this stuff, unfortunately, you know, there's a low point in the story. We won't go there in Genesis, you know it. Adam and Eve decided that they were going to do life on their own terms. And so instead of saying, okay, God, we want to walk in this relationship with you, they decided maybe we should do some of this stuff by ourselves. And they ended up breaking everything. Death became a normal part of life. Unfortunately, death was never meant to be natural. And so what we do now is we get so used to this broken world that we start to think this is reality. This is not reality. I mean, the fact that those prayers were up a while ago is so sad. Like, how many testimonies of cancer and brokenness and disease this is not reality. This is a broken world we live in. And so I kind of want you to almost stop for a second and reactivate something really deep in you that tells you that who you really were meant to be. You were created for royalty. You were created to be a prince and a princess in a kingdom. God created us to rule over a world, to represent Him, to be His image on earth. I mean, that is just so fascinating. It's really hard to actually drink in and really process. It's like, yeah, I get it, but it's like, I don't get it. Like, if I tell you, like, think about the infinity of space. It's like an instant headache, right? Like, how do you picture that? But this kind of stuff is in that same sort of class of truth. Now, God decided in His incredible mercy that I'm not just going to leave it like that. I'm going to start with this process of fixing this world, of redeeming it. And so step one kind of starts with Abraham. So God says, okay, I gave Adam and Eve these specific promises, these blessings. I kind of created them to represent me. I'm going to start over with this whole thing. Now, there's actually, this whole rescue operation will be fulfilled sometime later, but I'm going to start something in motion. And so step one ends up being Abraham. And really what it comes down to is God just saying, Abraham, I'm starting with you. I'm going to bless you. All that stuff that Adam screwed up, I'm giving it back to you. But it's really not about you. You're just like step one. Step two is really Israel. I don't want you to remain a single person. I want you to bless and again become this humankind that will spread all over the world and again be this representative of God. Again, this people that's supposed to rule over the world and bring God's kingdom. The story kind of goes a little bit further then where Israel ends up being in the promised land and they look around and they see all these other nations and they have a king. So Israel tells God, but we also want a king. And then God tells them, listen, that's really a bad idea. Because first of all, I am your king. So I'm kind of offended that you don't recognize me as your king. But secondly, kings on this earth, unfortunately, are somewhat human and subject to the same brokenness that you suffer. If you get a king, it's probably going to mess some stuff up for you. And so the very first king that ends up getting onto the picture, King Saul, royally screws everything up. I mean, he really ends up being a lunatic in a short period of time. And then in this small glimpse, God gives this king that's, again, this like Abraham, that's this picture of something that's supposed to happen. God brings David, which is this amazing king that celebrates so much of what it is supposed to be like to be in God's king. This king who's good, this king who cares for the poor, this king who actually comes from not a very wealthy background himself, this king who loves God. He's not just this person stuck in his bureaucratic office. He loves God. He's in love with Him, but he's also this warrior. He fights for the freedom of people. And so, and then after that, the story kind of goes down again. It's just one bad king after another. And then finally, when we get to the time of Jesus, there's all this expectation. So Israel now is oppressed. They are really struggling. The Romans are just abusing them left, right, and center. But over the centuries, they've picked up this hope, this belief that, again, a king will come that's going to fix everything, that will restore the kingdom, that will again give us back this identity that we were born into. This dad, Abraham, that we find our identity with, will get that back. And so you have verses like Matthew 1, verse 22 and 23 that says, all of this occurred to fulfill the Lord's message through the prophets. Look, the virgin will conceive a child. She will give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. And that verse comes from Isaiah. So the Israelites had this idea that, wow, this Messiah, this king, this special, special anointed king will return, and he's going to make everything good and right for us. But then something happens. God, like, shocks everybody. They were really not expecting, they were expecting a person to come. They were expecting another human being to come and fix things. But then what does God do? God comes Himself. I mean, let's just stop for that on that point for 1 second. Like, let's just get this straight again. So we're Christians. We claim to believe that God himself, the creator of this whole universe, somehow living in heaven, living in a kingdom, in a palace that, I mean, obviously the Windsor Castle pales in comparison to this kind of castle, this kind of royalty, this divinity, would somehow step out of that into our world as a human being. Is that weird? Or am I the only one? It kind of sounds like Hercules or something. You know, the Greeks had their mini version of that. So, you know, the god will kind of have a relationship with some earthly woman and produce this little kind of god human. We kind of laugh at that. It's a fairy tale. But then when we really think about Jesus, here we claim that God himself did something similar to that, but extraordinarily more crazy. And the reality is a lot of people struggle with that. Jehovah's Witnesses say, no way, Jesus wasn't God, he was just an angel. Islam says, no way, that Jesus wasn't God, he was just a prophet. Sort of spiritual humanism says, no, Jesus wasn't God, he was just a really nice teacher. Sort of more secular humanism will say, that's all rubbish. But we actually, if we actually stop and think about how extravagant that is, that a king would do that, and obviously, if you're God, that's not impossible. Like, nothing stops me to put on a jacket and step into the cold, and that keeps me warm. For God to kind of take humanity on as his jacket and step into our universe is easily within his grasp. But to think of a person that would do that, like, how incredible is that? That this king, this creator of the universe will leave everything and step into our world. I mean, think about that. I'm sure God could have fixed this world by swinging some kind of magic wand in heaven and just being like, you know, kaboom, and the whole world is back to normal. Or somehow it's restored. But the fact that he will leave everything and step into our world to come physically, hands and feet, a mouth, a body, in person, to come and touch and speak, to say like God himself cares so much that he would step into this world to change everything. And then let's look at a couple of these verses. Colossians 1, verse 15 to 20. Please read this verse as if you've never read it before. Like look at the extravagance and the size and the weight of this verse. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I think, go and read that verse again this week. I mean, it's almost too full and too much to process all of that and, like, you know, just listening to it. I mean, words like all, complete, fullness, everything held together. Did you know that in all of the amazing discoveries in science, with quantum physics and subatomic particles, they still don't know how gravity works? Did you know that? They don't know how gravity works. It's still one of the unsolved parts of physics. So this verse kind of makes me just kind of chuckle, because it actually even says there that God holds himself together. I wonder what that really means, you know, to which extent Jesus literally not only created this world, but maybe somehow the very reality of gravity is a part of Jesus consistently keeping this world together. But the more beautiful part of it really happens in Philippians 2, verse 5 to 9. And it says, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. Another verse that kind of connects with that is in Mark 10, verse 45, which says, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Think about that. Here's this king of this universe. He leaves everything to come in person to us, to remind us that we are royal, that we are not abandoned children. We are no longer these slaves living on this earth all by ourselves, but that we were created for him. And so Christmas is kind of this, it's this collision between heaven and earth. It's this collision between royalty that comes to redeem slavery. And then Jesus goes on to transform everything. And we'll read a couple of verses like that as well. So 2 Corinthians 5 verse 17 says this: "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he's a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come." Would you apply that to your own life? How do you view yourself really? Do you view yourself kind of as a, you know, maybe you see a lot of sort of just bumps in your own life, just dents. Now, you've kind of had a couple of crashes throughout your life. Do you realize that God says you're a new creation? And unfortunately, a part of us can't see that yet, but there's a miracle that happens inside of us. When you're born again, it's not just some little nothing that happens. There's something inside of you, spirit, that was dead, that's raised from the dead. I mean, it's like if we bring somebody today here that's pretty much dead and we pray for him and he gets up, I'm pretty sure a couple of newspapers will show up, right? That's pretty hardcore, spectacular stuff. The reality is every single person in relationship with God have actually experienced that already. You might not see it, but that's a truth that's inside of you. What if we would live like this every morning? What if we would live like that every time we've made a mistake and we've sinned and we've kind of screwed up? You know, if we would go with that confidence before God that, wow, because of your goodness, I'm royal and I'm actually a new creation. Not once, but that's the gift that God gives us every day. It goes on in 2 Corinthians 3 verse 18, and it says, "And we all with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is Spirit." I mean, isn't that just amazing? We are being transformed into the image of God. And then Romans 12 verse 1 to 2 says, "Therefore I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship." And then verse 2, "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what is God's will, his good and pleasing and perfect will." So I need to tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a princess, and she had this golden ball that she loved to play with. And one day, she ended up walking in a field, and she got to this pond, and she was playing with her ball, and suddenly her ball fell into the pond. And she was really sad. And as she was kind of sulking over her lost ball, a frog peeked his head out. And he said, "Hey, princess, what's the problem?" And she said, "Well, I lost my ball, and, you know, I'm so sad. I really love this ball." And the frog's like, "You know what? I'll help you. I'll make a deal with you. I'll dive down and find your ball for you, and then I'll give it back to you, but then you have to kiss me. And if you kiss me, I'll actually turn into a prince." And have you guys heard this story before? Have you? You haven't. This is a different story. And so the princess ends up getting her ball, and she kisses this frog, but actually this frog was really lazy. And so he just kind of like gave the princess this half-hearted kiss back. And so as the princess kisses this frog, he transforms, and his head becomes this human prince, but the rest of his body stays a frog. And so he ends up this horrible abomination. He's completely alienated from all frogs and people. He lives in a cave, horrible, lonely existence, and he dies a miserable death. The princess goes on to go through numerous psychotherapy sessions that eventually gets her back on track. The end. Have a nice day. We like that story. That's a pretty poor story, right? The point is, Have a transformation is an ugly thing, right? It's when transformation takes its full course that you end up with the breathtaking fairy tale where you say, this is beautiful and I want in on that. Now, something that I've realized just living in a different number of countries is that there's something called the meta-narrative. That's a big, ugly, wonderful word that I love. Anybody heard that word before? Meta-narrative really just says, it's this overarching story that you believe that defines all of the hard questions in life. Who am I? Where do I come from? What's important? Where am I going? It's really if I could take you and put you on an island and say, sorry, the whole world exploded. You're the last human being. Actually, there's one other baby that's left. You need to write down absolutely everything you know in terms of what is reality. And you get to give this to this little baby who will grow up, and that'll shape his whole existence. We all have these. And they deeply shape our cultures. They are deeply shaped by our countries. They are deeply shaped by religion itself. And these things kind of control how much we actually believe the Bible as it is. Now, the problem is, for a lot of us, is we end up with a fragmented sort of worldview. We kind of mix things in. It's sort of like a Christian version of Hinduism, where you have lots of little gods and you kind of do your own version of how you see God. And what we do sometimes is we have lots of sermons, we read lots of books, we have all our power verses, and we have this sort of scattered cloud of little verses. But the real overarching big story is missing in our lives. I can give you a really good example for that. Postmodernism says, you know what, it's really, really bad to tell people that you have the truth. In fact, it's politically incorrect. You shouldn't do that. It sounds wonderful, right? It sounds so polite. What it actually does, sort of the implication of that, maybe for humans it looks nice when you're postmodern. The implications for God is not capable of actually communicating himself accurately. Because one day he's this person, the next day he's that person, or maybe we can't know him altogether. Some religions say God's like this huge elephant. You know, some people see the trunk, other people see the tusk, another person see the hind leg. And, you know, I tell people, no, God is a hind leg. And another person tells people, no, God's a trunk. And then they say, you shouldn't do that because it's arrogant. You see a little glimpse of the elephant. And who are you to claim that you have the truth? The problem is that says that we cannot, this elephant is not capable of really communicating himself. So there's lots of interesting implications where if you actually stop and you zoom out, you realize, but that part of postmodernism is a big lie. Because God is this God of love and this God of relationship. And over and over and over, he communicates to us saying, first of all, I've done everything to communicate myself. And I want you to know me. And I want you to know me well. And it makes my heart sad when you misunderstand me. But we all kind of get intimidated by postmodernism sometimes, don't we? We feel, I don't want to be that jerk that kind of claims to have the truth. Now, there is wrong ways of talking about it. But the point is, some of those things start to shape us. Another real simple thing is just plain old materialism. The idea that if I get the right kind of stuff, I'll be happy. And for us as Western people living in a very capitalistic society, work is very important. It's really easy to start finding your identity and just how successful am I in my job and how much money do I make. And really, I mean, it's a really good example too is think about the amount of time we spend preparing for our careers, all the students out there. You spend a good 12 years just going to basic school. Then you spend so many more years going to further studies just to prepare for a job. Compare that, for instance, with the Hebrew culture, where they spent a good 7 to 10 years just learning the scriptures. Their idea was, we don't just need to learn how to do a certain kind of job. We need to learn how to live well. And we will invest our lives into that. So kind of my question today for all of us is, how pure is your story? This big story that defines your life, this transforming new reality that Jesus came to bring, how much of that is true in your life? And that's again where a kingdom is such a good picture, because a kingdom is absolutely all-encompassing. It takes everything. When you live in a kingdom, all the land belongs to the king. The king is the decision maker. You don't have a choice in that. Now, The bad part is we really don't have good examples of kings because we know only of human kings, people who abuse others, who want to just take everything for themselves, who manipulate and abuse. But if we look back at this sort of Philippians Jesus that says, I am king, but I'm not afraid to leave everything to come into your likeness and offer even my life so that I can restore your royalty. We are in relationship with a very, very good king. But this king did bring us his kingdom. And so the question kind of is, how fully have you bought into the kingdom story? If you, and I think kind of the Jesus step for us for this Christmas season is maybe spend some time and write down the story you really believe. You know, people kind of joke about it, you know, if somebody comes up to you and they're like, so what's the meaning of life? And people kind of chuckle like, ha ha, that's such an impossible question to answer. But it's not. The Bible completely claims to answer that question. I want to ask you in your own life, how do you answer that question? Is that story developed in your life? Is it an overarching thing that somehow has gone to affect every part of your life? Your family, your identity, your concept of possessions. It's no longer just 10%. It's like, Lord, here's everything. But because you're such a good king, I'm not just invited to be your slave. I'm invited to be your son. I can trust you with my life. Francis of Assisi, pretty radical guy in the Middle Ages. He got to a place where he was so fed up with religion that he pretty much said, I'm gonna live a life of poverty. So he literally took off his clothes, walked naked away and said, like, naked I came into this world, naked I'll go out of it. I'm starting from scratch. And he ended up, one of the things in Francis of Assisi's life was there were lots of leper colonies in that time, and it was untreatable. And so Francis of Assisi felt God challenged him with this idea of, like, how fully are you willing to kind of be incarnated, just like how Jesus left his palace to go to the brokenness of the world? How much are you willing to do that? And so he jumped on a horse, he rode to a leper colony, and he ended up kissing the lepers, all of them. And he kind of apologized to them and said, I'm so sorry for the fact that we as a society have completely pushed you away, and I just want to restore dignity and a sense of love to you. And he kissed all of them. Now, we know more about leprosy today, and it's not as contagious as they thought back then. But for Francis of Assisi, he was gambling with his life. And he ended up leaving a remarkable mark on history of just reminding people again that this Jesus we follow is about a lot more than religion and a lot more than Christmas stories. It's an invitation to be completely changed. But it's also an invitation to follow Jesus and say, God, here I am. And I understand that you are sending me as well to be incarnated somewhere in the world where your kingdom is not a reality, where there's brokenness and death and people still live as slaves, where they still live as these cursed frogs that have not received the kiss of God, that transformed them out of their brokenness, out of their slavery into royalty. A friend of mine is a surfer. I don't know if you guys know many surfer people, but they're a species in themselves. And they are normally quite a passionate bunch. And so this one friend of mine, he could just go on and on and on about, you know, the surfing conditions and whether there's an onshore wind or an offshore wind and the angle of the wind and how that shapes the wave formation and the power of the wave and this and that. And he could just, you know, no one had to ask him, could you like, we want to invite you to come and share the gospel of surfing. You know, it's just like, it just bubbles out of him because he's so fascinated by this world of surfing. The bottom line question I want to ask you is, how fascinated are you with the gospel? How fascinated are you with Christmas? The good news is that if you honestly can say, I'm just ridiculously fascinated by it, you probably haven't really heard the story yet. Or you've gotten so accustomed to it that you've ended up with a really, really watered-down version of it. God is in love with us. He gave everything so that we could be restored to this life of royalty with him. And he's inviting us to participate in this breathtaking, beautiful story. Over this Christmas period, may we remember the magnitude of that story. Take time this Christmas and write it for yourself. Ask yourself, can I answer this story? There's a book that I'm reading at the moment, maybe like for the third time. It's called A New Way to Be Human, written by Charlie Peacock. Such a cool book. If you want to read a little bit more about this, order that book on Amazon. It does such a good job of talking about God in not a systematic theology way, but in a narrative way. Kind of reminding us, what is this beautiful story that God is reminding us into? And how do we live this thing out day by day? And so this Christmas, may we all be reminded of who Jesus is. May we be reminded of this royalty that we've been invited to, that this life is short. And there's an eternity for us waiting. And this Christmas, may you find an opportunity to be Jesus incarnated to somebody around you. Maybe it's a poor person. Maybe it's just somebody that needs a kiss of love that will restore their dignity. May we enjoy the Christmas trees and the presents and beautiful Maastricht. But may that merely be a reminder that there's something much bigger waiting for us, a much bigger gift we've been received. And may we find opportunities to give this gift to others this month.